and speak today and to listen. Most of you are very familiar with aquaculture. You've got a lot of it in New England. A couple of weeks ago, I picked up the Northeast U.S. Aquaculture Calendar for 2007, which the state of Connecticut put together for the Northeast Aquaculture Conference. Everything from shellfish to salmon to hatchery activities to stock enhancement. There's been a lot going on in New England in aquaculture for a long time. It's at a modest level. It's modest around the country as well, relative to seafood supply and demand. So why all the interest in aquaculture at the moment? Is there an opportunity for New England? Can this be taken to the next level? You're all familiar with the drivers. Doctors and nutritionists are asking us to eat more seafood for the health benefits, but we're importing 80% of our seafood. U.S. commercial catch supplies only about 15% of what we consume. U.S. aquaculture, another 5%. We certainly have the technology. We have the ability to do more aquaculture here in the U.S. The real question is, do we want to? Do we want to make room for it? And we've got lots of challenges. We've got very high coastal land values. We value our recreation and tourism opportunities. We value unspoiled views. Some people don't want to see working waterfronts. We have a complicated regulatory system. In coastal waters, we have no regulatory system in federal waters. I don't quite need that yet. But we don't have much of a small but not a very large research and development infrastructure around aquaculture in terms of extension services, research on feeds, nutrition, disease, and so on, which is important to any agricultural industry. We don't have much in the way of economic incentive programs or insurance programs for aquaculture. All of these are constraints. These are constraints that I know from firsthand experience as well. Before coming to NOAA a couple of years ago, in the early 80s, I started a shrimp farming company with some partners and farmed shrimp in those coastal tidal ponds in South Carolina for 15 years or more, where we converted old duck hunting ponds and rice fields to shrimp farming. You know, it's got a tide that comes in and out. You can replace the old wooden flap gates with pipes and a riser board assembly to control water levels. And we killed a lot of shrimp the first few years. We went to Japan and the Philippines and other places to learn how to do it. Initially, we had our own hatchery on Hilton Head Island and ran a pipe into the water and played with hatching shrimp. Well, of course, that wasn't very efficient long-term, so we started buying from hatcheries in Florida or Texas or Panama. We tried polyculture with oysters, with other finfish. We did research projects in the Caribbean and Latin America. And for 10 or 15 years, we made a go of it. At some point, we needed real capital to expand. We'd put our own money into it. We'd taken out bank loans. We, in effect, bootstrapped a company, learned how to make payroll and get product to market. But it was small. To get to the next level, we needed a lot more space. We needed investment. We needed insurance. And all of that wasn't there. Prices came down for shrimp. There were a lot of disease issues. So we all went off in the 1990s and did our other things, and the company has become a hobby. I went to the World Bank for 10 years, financed agribusiness projects around the world. Another guy runs the Sea Grant program at one of the states in the southeast. Another guy runs an electron microscopy lab. This is very typical of aquaculture companies around the U.S., I think. So there's been a lot of technological innovation, a lot of promise, but it's still very modest. So why am I back? Well, I got tired of globetrotting, for one thing. I wanted to do something here in the U.S. And there have been huge amounts of advances in technological innovation in the past 10 or 15 years, which I think gives the U.S. an unusual opportunity over the next 10 or 15 years if we solve these regulatory and social issues to jump into aquaculture and really make a difference in terms of our seafood supply. It won't be easy. There's a lot of work to do. But I think in some ways the stars are aligning to give us a chance to do that over the next few years. There's a lot of it. This is a national priority. The Ocean Commission report said we need more aquaculture. This current administration is firmly behind aquaculture. There's a new marine or offshore bill that's been reintroduced in Congress. The Secretary of Commerce is going around saying aquaculture, aquaculture, and visiting sites. So I wanted to give you a brief overview of what we've put together over the past 2 years as a NOAA aquaculture program, a little bit about this marine bill, which is before Congress, show you a few pictures of one promising area of aquaculture innovation, offshore aquaculture, and then take any of your questions. A year and a half ago, shortly after I started, MAFAC, NOAA's Marine Fisheries Advisory Committee, asked the aquaculture program to put together a 10-year plan. So we went around the country for a year sort of asking leading questions and asking coastal communities, fishermen, aquaculture entrepreneurs, state fisheries directors, seafood processors and others, what kind of a program would you like us to have? And we've put that together in this 10-year plan. We ran it by MAFAC last July. MAFAC, to my surprise, unanimously endorsed it, asked us to do a little refining. It went out for public comment last November, and there are drafts on our website. A final version should be available within the next few weeks. It focuses on four key areas of activity for the program. Regulation, 2, research and development, 3, outreach and education, and 4, international. Under research, we're trying to do two things. Let me start with regulation. Under regulation, we're trying to do two things. First, to do a better job under existing laws and regulations. We have a lot of laws and regulations that apply to aquaculture already, state and federal. But when it comes to NOAA fisheries and NOAA's role in that regulatory process, the people in the regional offices who have to comment on these permits don't have sort of the support or the information to make quick permit decisions. So we're trying to provide our regional offices with the tools that they need to do those reviews for Corps of Engineers and EPA permits under Magnuson-Stevens, under endangered species, under marine mammals laws. The second part of regulation is federal waters. We don't really have a good system for permitting aquaculture in federal waters. You could go get your Corps permit, your EPA permit, but then you would come to NOAA Fisheries and in a sense you'd be stymied. You can get an exempted fishing permit to do a research project, but you can't get a permit to do long-term aquaculture in federal waters under fisheries laws. So a variety of national commissions asked NOAA to put together draft legislation. That legislation was floated a couple of years ago. We heard a lot of comments. We've revised it. It's been sent back to Congress. I'll say more about that in a couple of minutes. On the research and development side, there's both internal research and external research. I think we need to have enough internal research at NOAA for NOAA to be an effective regulator, to know enough about the industry, to know enough about fisheries management, environmental issues, user conflict issues, to be a good regulator. So this means the NOAA Fisheries Labs, the NOS Labs, have to have enough in-house capability to be able to answer these public policy questions. So we've laid out a program, and we're working with the NOAA Fisheries and NOS Labs to bring them back to a level where they can be good science partners in this process. There's also a fair amount of external research. OAR, the Sea Grant program at OAR, runs something called the National Marine Aquaculture Initiative, which is a competitive grants program. This past year made 11 awards for about $3 or $4 million. Again, a modest program, but quite an influential program in the research community. We also manage about $20 million of earmarks that go to university and nonprofit research institutions around the country. This doesn't include all of the salmon hatchery work, which could be considered aquaculture as well. There are opportunities for broader and bigger research dollars as well. For example, the Advanced Technology Program at the National Institute of Technology, or Standards and Technology, a sister agency of NOAA within Commerce, just announced its competition for 2007. It's got $80 million for high-risk, innovative ventures for private sector companies, $2 million grants. Aquaculture is eligible. So if any of you know companies that are working on the cutting edge of aquaculture, they ought to get their applications in the next couple of weeks. They're looking for aquaculture projects. Economic Development Administration, Small Business Administration, partnerships with USDA, we're looking at all of these various avenues for research and development. Third area is outreach. As the nation's science and oceans and fisheries agency, we need to get good information to the public and the decision makers about aquaculture. There are a lot of myths about aquaculture that have been floating around for years. As an agency, we need to be able to provide timely information about those key public policy issues in aquaculture, and we'd like to do a better job of that over the next few years. And somehow, out of our back pocket, we're supposed to handle all of these international treaty obligations, international scientific exchanges, which have become increasingly important in this world of globalization. Some fishery scientists, aquaculture scientists from NIMS can go on a 2 or 3 week study tour to Japan and save themselves 5 years of research in a lab on technology development, for example. These kinds of exchanges are very important to scientists. So we're trying to sort through historically what we've done in the international field, put some order of priority to it, because we have limited budget resources to be able to devote to that. That's a brief overview of the program and where we're going with the program. As I said, this 10-year plan will be, the revised one will be up on the website in a couple of weeks. I look forward to your comments on it. A couple of words about the Offshore Act. As I said, again, it's one part of this program. It's no longer just an Offshore Act. It's a Marine Aquaculture Act. If it's passed in the form that I think it will take, it will put NOAA squarely back in the aquaculture game. The bill is likely to it has two parts. It's likely to have three parts. It has a regulatory part, which deals with federal waters, again, to address this problem of not having a regulatory framework for federal waters. It has a research part, which would not just be for offshore, but for all of marine aquaculture. So shellfish farming, coastal aquaculture, marine stock enhancement as well would all be covered by this research provision. In addition, there are some senators who would like to put in an economic incentive provision into the bill. Again, that would be for all of marine aquaculture. So this would be for things like the fishery finance program to raise their debt ceiling level to be able to make more loans to the aquaculture sector. Other grant, Economic Development Administration kinds of provisions are being talked about as well to put into the bill. So there's a summary of the bill, I think, in your packets. The entire draft bill is in there as well. On the regulatory front, it would authorize the Secretary of Commerce to actually issue a permit for aquaculture in federal waters, something that's not possible today. It would also ask the Secretary of Commerce to in effect, set up a one-stop permit shop to coordinate the activities of the other federal agencies and to work with state agencies and the other players in the regulatory field. There would be a strong role for states and for fisheries management councils. Again, the bill would exempt aquaculture activities from the Magnuson-Stevens Act, but only in terms of size, limits, or season. All of the other provisions of Magnuson-Stevens still apply. So if you want to go take broodstock or juveniles from the wild, all the coordination under fisheries management, all the coordination with councils still apply. There's a strong environmental requirements section in the bill. I think the bill is set up to be very businesslike and efficient in terms of timelines for the private sector. It has a very strong monitoring and enforcement provision to it. Anyway, we'll see. The bill has, I think, strong support in Congress at the moment. We expect it to be introduced in the House and the Senate shortly. National Fisheries Institute, National Aquaculture Association, Soybean Association, Veterinarians Associations are all strongly supportive and have been lobbying for the bill. There is some opposition from some environmental groups and some fishing groups who see aquaculture either as part of a problem or as competition. But I think we all know the real competition is imports. The real competition is everything else which competes for that center of the plate. The choice before us is really, do we want to think of aquaculture as another tool to produce seafood, to complement commercial catch, to supplement recreational fishing, to enhance or to recover endangered species or habitat? This is what's being done in many other countries and is being done on a modest level in the U.S. So let me show you a few pictures of some of the technology development that's happened in the offshore area. And I could have a similar set of pictures for innovations in shellfish farming, innovations in salmon farming, innovations in marine stock enhancement. But since the attention has been offshore, and that's one of the new areas of development, a couple of these pictures. Okay, what do I need to do here? We don't need that. I think we all realize the EEZ is a big area. A little bit on finfish farming. You may have all seen these pictures of these conical-shaped central spar cages that have been deployed on an experimental basis and by fledgling commercial operations in Hawaii, Puerto Rico, and New Hampshire. There's a schematic of them. They've been in operation now for 4 or 5 years. Good success in terms of operation. They hold together. They've learned a lot about here's what a schematic looks like in terms of how they're anchored. Most of them are three to four cage operations. I think in the future we may see self-positioning cages as well. Or single point anchor cages. So there's a lot of innovation happening. Here's some pictures from Hawaii where they have both nursery cages. You can see them on the bottom right, as well as these central spar cages. They've now developed them where they can bring them to the surface to clean them. They can flip them. They're working on robotic web cleaners. As you might imagine, biofouling is a big problem. One of the newer designs that's being deployed off Puerto Rico is called an aquapod. It was actually developed in Maine and New Hampshire by some guys who used to be in the salmon farming business. So a lot of this technology development, a lot of the investors and entrepreneurs who have gone into this are all from the U.S. In Hawaii, the first operation was started by a commercial fisherman and salvage boat operator, the second operation by some guys who were in pearl farming, the one in Puerto Rico by a young fellow whose father and uncle had been in the seafood business for a long time. In New Hampshire, they're also testing a small cage. See the one on the top right that was developed by the soybean industry and has been used in China for a couple of years. So rather than cages that are 3,000, 5,000 cubic meters in size, and I'll show you some pictures in a minute of 40,000 cubic meter cages that are being tested in Norway, these would be 100 to 300 cubic meter cages that could be deployed off of an existing fishing boat. So they're going to test those in the wave tank at the University of New Hampshire this year as well as offshore. Here's some schematics of things that are in development around the world. You can let your imagination run wild in terms of the kinds of technologies that are going to be deployed in offshore areas. It's not just the U.S. that has these coastal issues in terms of high land values and competing issues for space. All around Europe, they have the same issue. In Asia, they have issues of cage culture operations and coastal pollution from one end to the other, forcing operations further offshore. So even though the technology costs can be more expensive for going offshore, the water quality is much better, and in general, the user conflicts may be less. So you're balancing these trade-offs between perhaps costs, better production, and so on. It's not just finfish. University of New Hampshire has been pioneering with shellfish farming. The bottom right-hand side, you can see these grid systems of mussel long lines that have now been in use for a couple of years, and some commercial fishermen have started their own venture called Isle of Shoals. Here's what the finished product looks like. And as I understand it, there are – this picture's a little small for people in the back row to see, but Roland Barnaby is here, and when I'm done, I think we'll provide a couple of minutes of update about what's going on with some of the University of New Hampshire projects. But both the mussel culture and the finfish culture, Roland and others went down to the docks and got commercial fishermen and others in the seafood business involved in the design of these projects and the operation of these projects. So it's an exciting possibility. And there are fishermen up and down the New England coast who are looking at these. And there's a project in Santa Barbara, California that's also going in using this muscle long line technology. Again, pictures of some of the operations around the country, wide variety of people involved. Some of this is high tech, remote cameras, remote acoustics, doing things off New England. The water's rough. You don't want to be out there every day. Feeding buoys that you can go fill once a week. The one on the bottom left is, existing University of New Hampshire feeding buoy. The top right is a feeding barge in Hawaii. Bottom right is a new feeding station the University of New Hampshire is going to deploy this year. The species currently being grown are, in terms of promise, are cod in New England. A couple of the species in Hawaii, an amberjack and a Pacific threadfin or moy. Cobia, I think, is the new one of the new wonder fishes of the world that's being used in the Caribbean, and mussels on both coasts. When I go to aquaculture conferences for the past couple of years, it's all about cobia and yellowtail. And we have huge opportunities for yellowtail in California. But again, we don't have the regulatory structure in place to allow us to do it, so investors are going to Mexico. I think that's it in terms of pictures. Why don't I stop there? We can either have Roland come up for a couple of minutes, or we can take some questions now. How would you like to do this?
We'll address your part of the presentation now from the council, and then Roland can come up. Anyone on the council have any questions? Mike, Rip?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, Mike. That great presentation. I wanted to make some comments, and then I had a couple of questions. I don't know how many years ago it was that the salmon aquaculture became as popular or was into the growth mode. It was deemed to be the savior for the Atlantic salmon wild stocks, and while it may have had some benefits in that direction, we do know that it has caused some substantial problems, and in some areas has impacted the wild stocks dramatically. Some of those things can be overcome. I think that it wasn't realized what some of those impacts would be, to do with the siting of the aquaculture operations, the moving them around to keep the impacts from the benthic habitat from happening. But one of the things that has become apparent is that there are today many, many times the number of salmon in cages than there ever were in the wild. And those fish have to eat something. And what's happened, or what appears to have happened, is that the forage base for the wild stocks is getting dramatically impacted, primarily to be used as feed for all of these fish that are in cages. And that is impacting the ability of the wild salmon to survive. Now, getting off of salmon for a moment and thinking in terms of where the aquaculture industry can ultimately go, and I support some of the concepts, but I'm hoping that as this kind of legislation is pushed through, that people are thinking about all of these impacts and perhaps hopefully some sort of research is being done on whether it's new soy-based feeds or those kinds of things that will mitigate these potential impacts. Because if you don't do that, then certainly you may produce a very, very good product, but you will continue to impact the wild stocks. And if people are saying that this is one of the things that can help rebuild a sustainable stock of wild fish out there, we want to make sure that is something that, in fact, does happen.
Well, first of all, conserving wild stocks and protecting the environment are absolutes as far as NOAA is concerned. And I think anything that goes forward in terms of the federal government's involvement in aquaculture starts from that basis. So we need to maintain, and the aquaculture industry depends upon a healthy environment as well. So in terms of impacts that aquaculture creates, of course, we've learned a huge amount over the past 30 years from salmon, from shrimp, from catfish, about what to do, what not to do. There's been a huge amount of innovation. There's been a huge amount of learning by doing. And lots of mistakes were made. And aquaculture, like any kind of agricultural activity, can be done well or can be done poorly. You just got to look around the world. So I'd like to think that here in the United States, we are currently doing it quite well. But that doesn't mean there's not room for improvement. For example, we've got scientists looking at the genetics issues to take models from stock enhancement, information from salmon, from redfish, from snook and others, and adapt those models to, say, escapes from net pens so that we have good information as fisheries managers to be able to say, you know, what to allow and what not to allow as this moves forward. We've learned a lot about siting in terms of water quality. In terms of fish meal, I take a little bit of issue with what you're saying. The amount of the fish meal stocks in the world have stayed pretty constant for the past 20 years. The price has doubled during the past year, so maybe we have reached that limit. But most of the fish meal in terms of aquaculture is going to China. It's not going to the salmon industry. It's going to China to feed carp, interestingly. Or it's going for pork, for poultry, and pet food. That's not to say that because the price has doubled that feed, whether it's from fish meal or from any other protein sources, that's going to be a significant constraint going forward. And I think we've seen from salmon and other finfish operations that they've become extremely efficient in terms of food conversion. And they're all scrambling for alternatives, whether it be soy or other kind of grain products, single-celled yeasts, algaes, animal byproducts, products, you name it. If you go to a company like Nutreco in Europe, the largest aquaculture company, they've got a big spreadsheet of all of their operations that they supply around the world, all of the various feed ingredients, prices, availability, and from week to week they can rejig that. Salmon and other fish don't need to eat fish. They just need different protein sources in different combinations. And there are a whole variety of ways to supply that, and it really comes down to price. So in terms of fish meal, it's really a wild stock management issue. If you're managing wild stocks well and you're not overfishing, it seems to me it shouldn't matter what you're using that feed for. And there may be cases where it's a good idea to feed fish to fish. If you get down too low in terms of fish meal and fish oil in your feed and you don't replace that with an equivalent protein that's high on omega-3s, the human nutritional benefit gets reduced. So there's a trade-off there as well. But the bottom line is I think we're very cognizant of these issues as an agency, as a program. We'd love to have a bigger research and development program to address these things going forward. And these are things we take very seriously.
Just one follow-up. Knowing that, as you have indicated, that in other parts of the world, aquaculture or marine aquaculture is substantially larger than here in the United States. Is there any effort at the federal level to build up some kind of international organization like ICAT or, you know, any of a major convention that would work on some of these issues on an international level? Because obviously other things that are going on potentially impact all of our fisheries.
It happens in two ways now, I think, or a couple of ways. FAO, the Food and Agriculture Organization, has got an aquaculture committee that meets regularly. Admittedly, it's a lot of talk, but they come up with some nice summary reports and sort of state of the world aquaculture, who I think helps inform all of us about where this is going, and it's certainly a forum for exchange of information. There's a lot of scientific exchange that goes on even outside the realm of government. Take a cobia, for example. You wouldn't believe how much is going on and how fast it's going on. Everything from larval development to feeds to, I mean, they can now do a fish meal free cobia, to closed recirculating systems to offshore culture of cobia. And it's all happening in the private sector, and it's happening around the world. U.S. companies with French companies, with Asian companies, all talking to each other, each taking part of that research need and rejigging it every 6 months. The other area, I think, on the environmental front and the best management front is the market and market certification is becoming international and is pushing particularly other countries towards best management practices. We've seen this happen in shrimp with Global Aquaculture Alliance's Aquaculture Certification Council. The Aquaculture Certification Council is taking on finfish certification as well, and they plan to work with WWF and the Packard Foundation. And I think NOAA will contribute, and the Canadian government and others will contribute in terms of research for particular areas of best management practice that need to be done. So I think we'll see it happen on that front as well internationally.
Sally?
Yeah, thank you. Just a few questions. The NEPA review requirements in the proposed legislation, it doesn't seem that it's clear that a programmatic EIS is required, and I'm wondering if you can describe the agency's position on what would be required for this new program.
Well, I think our interpretation is that a programmatic EIS would be required, and Bill Hogarth has said that we will do one. So, if Congress decides to pass legislation and gives us this authority to move forward, we'll have one of these typical two-year regulatory design processes, starting with a programmatic EIS. We may, even before that, do some work in New England and in the Gulf of Mexico on sort of a mapping exercise, which they're already well underway in the Gulf of Mexico. There'll be lots of consultations with states, with fishery management councils and others on, you know, what's the role of the states, what's the role of the councils, how do we sort through that. There, in terms of what kinds of regulations there'll be, just look at Maine, Washington, Texas, Florida, Canada, Australia. The models are already there. We've looked at them. They all start looking the same after a while. So I think there's a good body of knowledge to start with. We'll tweak that, float it for public comment, go through a Federal Register process in terms of coming up with the final regs. At the end of the day, we need something that everybody's going to buy into. If this is subject to lawsuits at the end, the investment money is just going to keep going elsewhere the way it is now, and we won't have aquaculture in federal waters. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, it does. A few more questions on the fish feed issue that was raised previously. I think only the research section of the bill makes mention of trying to reduce the amount of fish meal and fish oil in feeds. And I'm wondering if the agency is, if you're actually considering expanding that language beyond just the research section of the bill. Certainly, as you said, if a fishery is well managed, then it shouldn't be a problem where the total allowable catch goes, where it ends up going, if it's a well-managed fishery, but there's supply side, there's demand side. And if there's increased demand for fish meal, then there are going to be pressures to produce more. So I'm wondering if you can just elaborate on that a little bit more as far as what the agency intends on doing and potential changes in the legislation, aside from the mention of fish feed in the research section.
A couple of ways to answer that. I think the federal government has given this legislation its best shot in terms of the NOAA aquaculture program and NOAA redrafting a bill, putting it through the interagency review process, the OMB process, and sending it to the Hill. It's not a perfect bill. It's not even perfect in terms of what I would want in the bill because it went through that interagency process. But it's a framework. It's a start. Now I think it's up to Congress and all of you collectively to decide what you want to do with it. In terms of fish meal, I think it's the agency would say this is a fisheries management issue. As I said, it's not an aquaculture issue. But we have a number of ways of getting at this, fisheries management being one, research and development being another. As I said, the market is taking care of this perceived fish meal issue. And there may be opportunities in the U.S. for, like the sardine squished tuna fishermen on the West Coast are catching sardines that are being shipped to Australia and Mexico for aquaculture. They'd like to use those in California, as an example.
One more question, if I could, and it relates to non-fishing impacts under the Magnuson Act. I'm just trying to figure out how to reconcile if There's an aquaculture program in NOAA, and the council, the fishery council, looks and sees, okay, there's this proposed offshore aquaculture project. It's going to have impacts on X, Y, and Z essential fish habitat. It's a big project. It's something that potentially should be elevated to the secretarial level, but then that doesn't make sense because it would be the Secretary of Commerce talking to the Secretary of Commerce. You see what I'm saying? Because if normally the council would be reviewing the Army Corps of Engineers, permitting a project for beach replenishment or the Cape Wind project, for example, and then the elevation would go to the Secretary of Commerce and the Secretary of the Army. So how would that happen if there was a large project? How would the council be able to work with National Marine Fisheries Service to elevate it? It doesn't quite make sense to me.
Yeah, I'm not quite sure I understand the question completely, but we'll have to figure out what the actual process is going to be under this, if this legislation is passed, in terms of the roles of all the various players and actors. So that's something that we've been discussing with council chairs already, for example, at a preliminary level, to sort that out. The Department of Commerce and NOAA have a whole variety of responsibilities in terms of balancing multiple uses. Federal agencies are routinely asked to develop things as well as to protect things. So this is nothing new in terms of having to balance those potentially conflicting uses and come out with something that is acceptable in the end. But I think we have lots of experience going through public processes, getting consultations, working with states, working with fisheries management councils. But we'll have to go through a design process, I think, to answer your question in terms of definitively how the process would work.
Okay. And obviously I think that's something that's important. And I would suggest that, you know, especially people at this table who are on the Habitat Committee know the frustration that we have when we have a major project in front of us and the council has an opportunity to comment and we submit a comment. And then that's kind of the end of the ability for the council to have any part in the decision making in real terms. I mean, certainly there's the opportunity for elevation, but in the context of aquaculture, I think it's worth considering that the council should concur with a project in terms of its potential impact and mitigation measures that are proposed and negotiated between the permittee and the permitting agency and the council.
And none of that will change under this bill. I mean, the provisions of the Magnuson-Stevens Act, as I said, still apply. So in terms of essential fish habitat and consultations, that nothing's changed there.
I understand that, but the council doesn't have the ability to concur right now. The council can submit suggestions for mitigation measures for projects, but there's no final negotiation that would happen between the permittee and the council to have everyone agree, yes, this is okay, project can go forward. The council can say what the problems are. Typically, Army Corps of Engineers, all they're required to do is come back and say, okay, we're taking your advice, or we're not taking your advice, and this is why. So I'm saying that in this context of aquaculture and within NOAA, that it may be something that is appropriate to have a further back and forth between the council and the permitting portion of NOAA and the permittee.
Anyone else on the council? Dave Gaethel, then Dana Rice.
Yeah, thank you. I've read both the bill and basically all the documents that have been provided to us, and I'm trying to understand under the section on issuing permits how the people who may be displaced are represented. In other words, how do we? It says permits will be issued in consultation with an assortment of people, but it doesn't say how, as an example, the fishermen that are now displaced from that area are, I don't know if I want to say consulted or represented in this process. And it, I was wondering if you could just point me to which section of this might actually, you know, kind of protect their rights or their ability to comment in the process.
Well, I think in some ways you just mentioned that, that the bill has a variety of sections that say consult, consult, consult. From a practical perspective, also NEPA applies. So these projects will have to either do an EIS or an EA and deal with those conflicting use issues during that process. And that has a public comment process involved in it as well. I think on a practical level, though, none of these projects are going to go forward unless you guys work it out on the waterfront in terms of where to put these things. So I think going through a mapping exercise early on in a process, if any of these projects, say it's mussel longlining in New England that takes off, I think you're going to have to get together state by state or region by region and figure out where it makes, best makes sense to put these things, given the various conflicting uses. And there's a lot of room out there. Well, you're shaking your head. There isn't a lot of room out there. But they seem to have worked it out in Puerto Rico and Hawaii so far. And if you can't work it out, I don't think it's going to happen.
Okay, so just to follow up, then this word consult is the legal. I mean, going back to what Sally said, I mean, we consult on a lot of things. To me, I equate consulting with being ignored, quite frankly. You know, yeah, we send a letter and they go, yep, okay, that's nice. Next. So I'm just kind of for the record saying I'd like to see a word other than consult in there, that there's some binding, something that's binding, something that's more than we send a letter and somebody politely ignores it.
Dana?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Being from Maine and having some familiarity with aquaculture and experience or watching it over a period of time, we really don't have a lot of aquaculture in Maine. It's just very, very small tracts of things. And what seems to happen with aquaculture, I'm expressing some concerns more than a question or comment, but what seems to happen is aquaculture, in order to survive, has to be big bucks. Huge multinational corporations are usually behind it if it survives. Our history in Maine is, in down east Maine, especially salmon and other things, is the little guy starts and the little guy doesn't make it. My concern for this whole thing, I'm shaking my head when there isn't room up there. I know what happens on the other side of the Canadian line. We're in the experimental stages of such things now, and I'm not against that. The research and development, the need for protein is important, but once we get beyond the experimental stages and this starts to happen and all of these things come into play, the density or the acreage covered by these is going to be huge. It is in Europe and it is in other places, and it is going to have a huge impact on the Gulf of Maine, its ecosystem, the biology of other fish there, and the people and the wild fishermen that fish there. This very interesting. I followed this thing followed the information off the Isle of Shoals. There's a lot of stuff being developed there, but that's basically one cage that says you can do it. My concern for this whole thing is, obviously, it's going to take big bucks to do it, and it takes huge amounts of product to make it financially worthwhile for the investment. And the interaction with the states and all that, the state's not going to have any interaction in federal waters. It's going to be the council level, and I'm just concerned that I can envision places in the Gulf of Maine that are like a bay that's just across the Canadian line, that is absolutely saturated with salmon pens. I have a real concern there. And to take this What kind of bothers me about this, in the beginning of this morning, Paul gave a report in the council process that represents the management process in New England is flat funded, and there are millions and millions of dollars being put towards aquaculture. I'm a little bit concerned here. I may be tending to be a little bit negative about this process. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, anyone else in the council? Otherwise, I'm going to go to the audience. Roy, did you want to give a brief update on what's going on at UNH?
I think the last time that I actually came to a microphone here, Jim Salisbury was in his first term, and he and I had brown hair. So it's been a while, and I appreciate this opportunity. A little bit of history. At UNH, 15 years ago, a group of engineers and biologists got together and started talking about aquaculture and realized that we weren't going to do it like they've done it around the world and like they did down East Maine and Canada. We don't have protected sites. We have very busy coastlines. We have a lot of activities going on. So we decided to investigate in the offshore. So everything that we've done is in offshore, which means totally exposed sites. We actually have a site that's 7 miles offshore. We're in state waters because of the jog for the Isles of Shoals, but it's 170, 180 feet of water. We've developed most of the mooring systems that you saw today in these pictures and the cages. Feeding systems, fisheries monitoring systems have been done at UNH in the past 9 years. I think we started in 1999. We've had cages in the water since 99 and have never had a cage break loose, never had a mooring move other than a mussel mooring that a scallop I got into. We recorded a 12-meter wave at the site, I think it was 2 winters ago or 3 winters ago, and everything stayed together. We have successfully grown haddock, cod, summer flounder, and halibut. We presently have 45,000 cod in a cage. We've still got a lot of technological things we have to do, harvesting fish, moving fish. I think the big one is feeding. We can't get out there so many days in the winter, and that's why this technology that we've been working on for 10 years is now being used in places like Puerto Rico and Hawaii, because they can get out every day or most every day to feed the fish. The site is a demonstration site in that we have people literally come from all over the world. It seems like every single month I get a call from Rich. We've got somebody from Norway here. We've got somebody from Israel. We've got somebody from China. It's an incredible attraction for people that are interested in offshore open ocean aquaculture. The other part of it is shellfish, mussels. We've been growing mussels successfully on submerged long lines. We did it for 5 years and then decided that it was time to transfer the technology. We have a commercial fisherman right now that has 12 long lines in the water. What's a long line? It's about 600 feet long. The line that the mussels are grown on is 35 feet below the surface. The only contact with the bottom are 2 mooring blocks. And each one of those long lines can grow between 12 and 15,000 pounds of mussels. And we have several other fishermen that have contacted me and that are talking about doing it. And one of the problems is that when we talk about aquaculture, everybody thinks of the salmon farm. That's what came up here today. But think about growing 15,000 pounds on a long line that takes up the space of 12 lobster traps. We don't feed them. There's no waste. We don't need a hatchery. The only contact with the bottom are 2 blocks that are 600 feet apart. So that's one aspect of open ocean aquaculture that maybe we can use. I think I can tell you that the UNH group, as a group, since day one, has always pictured commercial fishermen being involved. Everything we've done, and we've also come to the realization that probably those cages and the feeding systems that we're using now, a commercial fisherman isn't going to be able to get into it. It is going to be a company, a big corporation. But one of those cages that you saw in those pictures is a small one that we believe a fisherman with a 40-foot boat could do. In fact, we're going to put one in the water, and we have a commercial fisherman. He has a, what's Dennis' boat, 40, 44? 44-foot dragger, who's probably going to take care of this cage and the fish. So that's where we're headed. I think within a year, somebody's going to be here asking you for a permit to put mussel lines in federal waters, so you might want to be thinking about it. Thanks.
Anyone else from the public? Ron?
Ron Smolowitz, Kunameset Farm. I just want to quickly remind the council that this is the council that actually led the country in offshore federal water aquaculture with the approval of amendment, the development and approval of Amendment 6 on the scallop plant, and that we had in federal waters the first permitted facility for aquaculture. It was 8,000 acres. It was the Seastead Project south of No Man's. It was highly successful. And it led the scallop industry into accepting the idea of area management. We were lucky. We had large sets of scallops. We've been living off of that. But I think we're going to be soon revisiting the Seastead concept, maybe Seastead 2, if you will, to look at seeding our special access areas. And that's sort of a large-scale, intensive form of aquaculture. And hopefully we'll be doing it through the fisheries management process as opposed to another more complicated system. Thank you.
Anyone else? Back. Harriet?
I've been watching the articles from Dr. Hogarth in National Fisherman. And I think perhaps it's more the reverse, that it's come from National Marine Fisheries to the president, than that the president is worrying about what's going on with all the other things I feel is more important at this point that he has. And I'm not saying that there cannot be applications. I'm not really knowledgeable. But just as an ordinary person involved in fishing, I think it's a death rattle for fishing. And when I hear about large areas going to be closed for conservation, there I can see where they could put their farms or whatever they want, cutting back fishing, getting rid of fishing people. It's like a puzzle, and it seems to fit together. And the two gentlemen, I don't know their names, Mr. Rice and the other, have all of the same concerns, the first person from the council that spoke. And I think it's, I would certainly lobby my senators and congressmen not to go for anything like this at this point. I hear here all the time there's a shortage of money to do things we need, to do the proper research. And just today with the albatross, if it was to be held another year so there could be more calibration, or the ocean is a new frontier. And there's always a shortage of money here. Always I hear about it. Well, we'd like to do it, but it's money. But all of a sudden there's a lot of money now to go into something else that we really don't know a lot about. Oh, it may be on a small scale, like Mr. Barnaby said, maybe those things are working. But small scale, as this gentleman said, he left it himself. It wasn't profitable. And I read about the shrimpers down in the Gulf, how they tried to get a countervailing duty. Mr. Barnaby and myself and Jim Salisbury many years ago worked on a countervailing duty for fish against Canada. I would like the council to be as cautious as they could with any influence they have on this. And I certainly would lobby my senators and congressmen at this time, because, okay, maybe a few fishermen get a job. What are we going to do with all the rest of them? Thank you.
Anyone else? Jim Kendall.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Jim Kendall, New Bedford Seafood Consulting, a former at-wild fisherman, I guess. And I think you're going to hear the same thing from me that you've heard from a lot of the people who are actually invested or involved with the wild fishermen, so to speak. or the wild fisheries. It was mentioned that there's a lot of room out there, and in some respects that's true. However, since the early 90s, there's no longer the case that that area remains the same. There is more or a larger proliferation of fixed gear out there that's unbelievable. There are areas that are no longer accessible to mobile gear fishers. So I think that sometimes when a statement like that is made, that it's a vast area, you don't have to worry, that doesn't ring true to the fishermen. I was lucky enough to get into Korea and Busan and see some of the fisheries that or the aquaculture that they had set up there. And while being very impressive and looking at it and seeing it myself, and I was impressed by it, but now that I think back at it, there is a taking of area, although this was inshore, that no one else could access. So for every giving, there has to be a taking. And the problem is they're taking it from the mobile gear fishermen or the fishermen who, like I described, as a wild fisherman. The numbers no longer are representative of what they were 10 or 15 years ago. Maybe that's part of the overall plan. A lot of us have to look at it that way because we feel like we're being taken from. All this being said, I did lobby for the Seastead site. I thought it was a good idea and a good plan. But Harriet made a good point about with the flat funding, I think Dana did also, with the flat funding that the council has, we can't depend on the council to be the one that's going to protect the wild fisheries. So we have to look and see who's going to do this. And until that's satisfactorily answered, at least, like I say, to the wild fishermen, I don't know who's going to protect our assets in that case. Thank you.
Okay. And, Tom, briefly. Tom Swin.
The UNH project wasn't flat funded. It was zero funded this year. So maybe that will make them feel better.
Tom Swim, New London Seafood. I have some experience in applying for permits for aquaculture projects, and actually what I found is there's no shortage of groups that review these projects, including inshore I'm talking about. Obviously, I don't have any experience offshore. But if you translate this to offshore and you add a few more layers of people that have to actually approve these things, instead of being parties to them, I wonder if, you know, you'll ever get any permits for these things. In Connecticut, I hate to speak poorly of the Connecticut DEP, but they reviewed a project and made a comment on the project which has no scientific value, and because of that the projects that I work with have been eliminated from doing some of their aquaculture. I don't know if this adds any information to this, but we're already facing, I'm reading here a quote, data poor stocks. Now, are we spending more money on the committee reviewing things, or are we going to spend more money on the research, which makes somebody able to make a decision that means anything? Thank you.
In the back, and then I'm going to come back to the council.
Good morning. My name is Ken Rieff. I'm an attorney from Gloucester, Massachusetts, former commercial fisherman and attorney for the Seasteads project back in the early 90s, and remember coming before this council for many years in order to get our approvals, and have been following the game, as it were, since then. I hear many things in the discussion, but one thing that does come through to me is that shellfish culture seems to be something that we can all talk about. I get the feeling every once in a while that finfish culture is sort of bogging things down, and I don't know if these are two trains on the same track or that they can be put on parallel tracks so that one can move forward while the other one does whatever it's going to do. So I would just like to put that before the council and to think of ways that we can move forward with things that we can agree on and discuss things that we don't agree on later in the story. Thank you.
Okay. Back to the council. Any further comments? Otherwise, we're going to go into the next agenda item. Okay. Thank you.
Thanks very much.
Mike, you don't need any time to set up, do you? Okay. Daniel, whenever you're ready, let's get into it.